Have you been hitting the books and listening to lectures all day? It's time to relax, to unwind, and listen up. This is Brooke from Campus Chronicles, your go-to podcast for everything student life. No matter where you are in your academic journey, we have you covered. Think of us as a trusted mentor, friend, and confidant who always has your back. We'll be sharing inspiring stories, thought-provoking insights, and practical advice to help you succeed in and out of the classroom. So get ready to be inspired, enlightened, and entertained. Hello, hello, everyone. I am so incredibly excited to introduce you to a wonderful person who I have already been having so much fun with off camera. His name is George Mycock, and he's the founder of Myo Minds. George, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to have this conversation. As I just said, I've been listening to your TEDx talk before we started recording, and I'm excited to hear you speak. You're so eloquent.
I'm excited to get into this space with you. I was telling George before we started that I'm a little bit of a student to what he's doing. I'm not incredibly familiar with it. So George, introduce us to your passion, your platform, what you're doing in the field of men's body image, which I think is so interesting.
Yeah. So let's put it in context. When we look at appearance concerns in men, so body image, disordered eating, relationships with exercise, a lot of the research is very early days. We don't know much. We tend to assume men's experiences based off of the research that's predominantly been done on women. And that means there's a lot of gaps, a lot of missing things. So my research is focusing a lot on men's eating and body image kind of concerns, pathology, men's body image, all around there. But my I suppose particular areas of interest and where my PhD is looking and what people might have seen me looking and doing work on in the past are around people's relationships with muscularity and wanting to become more big arms, but also lean as well, like six pack and abs and all that kind of thing, and how that affects men, boys, but also other genders as well.
Where did the interest originate? Because I think for girls, the interest will often originate, you know, fairly young. Girls start to dislike things about their body. Studies have shown as early as 5 or 6 years old. Where did your interest originate? And when does it start for men? I'm very curious on that.
Yeah. So again, a lot of the answers that I'm going to give to this are going to be this, that when we look at when the behaviors start for men in general, the research again is tricky to say, because the tools we use to measure it in men are again based on symptoms that a lot of men don't actually tend to align with. So we're more measuring men's when do men report scores that align with women rather than, and that tends to be roughly the same time as,
and that's a bit of a backward research. Most research is done on men, so I find this fascinating.
No, it is. It's yeah, I always say this. I'm in this really strange like echo chamber in the kind of a world of patriarchal structure. This is like the one like very, very small area where men are just like very much like ignored, not been looked at. It's very interesting. My own lived experience with these things, which is something that I have and I tend to share quite often. My own kind of concerns with this came from when I was a little boy. So I'd say probably from 8 upwards, but really started when I was 13, when I had a spinal injury playing rugby. And rugby for me was kind of my sense of worth, sense of self-identity. It was who I was, who I am, everything.
And sports is very much that way for young men.
Absolutely. And I think a big part of that and a big part that we see in the research that tends to align with boys and men's experiences with muscularity and issues around it is how it ties to masculinity and how boys and men tend, as they grow up, they tend to be told by somebody, by society, by whoever they're looking up to, that to be a man, you have to be able to endure pain, you have to be dedicated and disciplined, and you have to be able to kind of physically exert yourself. And sport is a beautiful way of showing that. It's an easy way of showing that. So rugby became that for me. And when I had this spinal injury. I was told that I wasn't allowed to play anymore. And that led to this kind of spiral of questioning who I was, this loss of what I felt was respect from people around me and respect for myself. And that led to me latching on to this fitness community and these often men influencers that I would find online who would tell me that if I want to be man enough, in air quotes, I have to do this workout, I have to do this training regime, I have to push myself to this limit and keep going. And I thought, oh, okay, all I have to do is just go to this building every day and do those things, and then I'll be good enough. And unfortunately, you never do feel that way, but I think a lot of people kind of get tied into that.
I saw something interesting yesterday on my Instagram. It was from some man, and it said, nobody cares, work harder. It was in relation to exercising. That reminds me a lot of what you're saying.
Absolutely. And it's something this isn't really my kind of research area. So I will take what I'm saying with a pinch of salt, because it is mostly theoretical here, but I'm really interested in those messages and that this kind of like masculine infused, nobody cares, nobody understands, these messages that seem to be so tightly aligned with the fitness community. There seems to be this kind of, yeah, like you say, that there's a really interesting paper by a woman called Hannah Stoyle who looked at athletes, and she was talking about whether or not there's a model in eating disorders called the tripartite model, which people who don't know, basically what it shows is that there are certain things that influence you to internalize a certain body ideal. So your kind of family, peers, and society. And Hannah was arguing in this paper that for athletes, the societal aspect doesn't actually work. It doesn't actually make sense. It doesn't fit, because when you're an athlete and you behave in these extreme ways, these extreme diets, exercise, etc., your friends and family and people around you don't understand, and general society tends to become the kind of outward group, tends to become the others. So you stop listening to them. So society doesn't really influence you anymore. And I think it's the same in these fitness communities, these like hypermuscularity communities of, you know what, we don't care what anyone else thinks because no one understands us. And like you say, you know, nobody cares. So just keep going, work harder. That these messages, which are dangerous, that's telling you, no, it's on the nose, isn't it? Nobody wants to help you. Nobody cares.
Well, it's emotionally and socially dangerous. And we have seen a rise, and this is not really related to what you do, but in aggressive, unhappy, and angry young men. And when you promote messages like nobody cares about you, work harder, you're not good enough, you're only feeding into that emotionally and socially.
Absolutely. And this is so funny, because I often have conversations with my director of studies, my kind of lead supervisor, Dr. Christian Edwards, and he often is trying to telling me to stop going down this rabbit hole because I'm so interested in it, but it doesn't align with my PhD. But I'm really interested in how the name I've often heard it be called is the manosphere, like the kind of Andrew Tate-esque, like those kind of things.
Oh, he's a rabbit hole we can certainly fall down.
Yeah, which maybe we shouldn't, but just maybe briefly, if we can continue if you want to. But there are bits of research looking at the kind of red pill community. Again, these are all terms that I could explain, but would probably take too long for the podcast. But there tends to be different kind of value systems within these groups. And one of them is this idea of, they often call it like the sexual marketplace and your sexual market value. And it's really interesting that the markers, one of the identity markers of kind of peak sexual market value, I'm using a lot of inverted air quotes here. I know people won't see the video, but just to understand, I'm using this a lot here. The kind of peak of that is a very muscular, very lean body. And a lot of the messages that they push across are these idea of self-improvement and trying to better yourself. And one of the key aspects of that is being muscular. And then when we look at the muscle dysmorphia research, which is the kind of clinical representation of body image issues around muscularity that we see a lot in men. But one of the most commonly correlated aspects with muscle dysmorphia is the ideas of threatened masculinity, of not feeling masculine enough and needing to prove it. So these kind of, they all seem to align. There seems to these kind of, these links kind of, you know, like the meme of Charlie from Always, is it Always Sunny, where he's got, or he's got the board up and he's got all those strings and the pins. It's kind of like that. I'm sat in my room doing that, just seeing all these links that, I don't really have an answer for what it means yet, but I do think there's something there.
When we think of university, you're introduced to so many different types of people that you may not have met prior to that. And you're in a situation where you could essentially compare yourself to hundreds of other young men. What was university like for you?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And I agree. Yeah, it's you're suddenly thrust into a world that you don't understand, because a lot of the time people have grown up in one place. Obviously people do move around, but a lot of time people have grown up around the same people, and suddenly you're now got all these other people to compare to, and that can be a real problem. But yeah, university for me was a real kind of rocky road. My kind of first year of university, my kind of appearance concerns were at their height. I was constantly spending time in the gym. Pretty much, you know, 99% of the people that I knew from university that I spent time with were people who I saw in the gym. It was at the point where I would study in the gym as well. You know, I'd get up, I'd go and train. I would then like sit there.
That is so Elle Woods from Legally Blonde.
Yes, if you've seen that. I actually watched that recently, which is funny. But yeah, so that kind of vibe. Yeah, so I would spend all that time there. And you know, if you asked me, I would have, and it's something that's really interesting with people with experiences of kind of muscularity orientated concerns, especially. It's very egosyntonic is the term people use, which is a very fancy way of saying it aligns with your values. You think it's good for you, even though there's a lot of evidence that it isn't. So if you'd asked me at that time in that first year, are you happy doing that? I probably would have said yes. But then if you asked me more specific questions of, oh, do you like feel sad that you don't get to see people other than these few people in the gym? Are you sad that you lost that friend that, you know, you saw that one time in a party, but now you never go to parties anymore because you're always training? You know, I would have been like, yeah, actually, that is pretty bad. But anyway, and then when it got into second year, that was when I started binge eating really bad as a kind of a, I now know, as a way of dealing with these emotions that I didn't like when my grades weren't as great as I thought they were going to be. I expected myself, you know, I was the classic kind of like high functioning at high school and then didn't do what, you know, suddenly was at a university where the grades were a lot harder to get, and then felt bad about that. And I was so ashamed of that I started binge eating, started kind of sitting at home and not going out, not speaking to anyone, not going to the gym, which, you know, is a difficult relationship because the gym is helpful for a lot of people, including myself to some degree, but was also a problem, and just led to this point where, you know, I had kind of hidden away for so long, and these thoughts and feelings had spiraled so much that I got to the point where, and I guess a bit of a trigger warning, so if you don't want to listen to this, go away, but I'd started to kind of experience these suicidal thoughts and started to plan how I was gonna take my own life. And I'm very fortunate that a friend of mine, almost by, I'm not particularly religious myself, but it felt like a kind of divine intervention, a friend of mine who I hadn't seen for a few weeks, just out of just kind of, I guess, a gut feeling, came and knocked on my door and asked me if I was okay on the day that I was planning on doing something. And yeah, I kind of broke down in tears in front of her, and yeah, I didn't tell her the full kind of idea of what was going on, but that led me to then seeking help and actually speaking to a counselor and started my journey of recovery from there. So that kind of second half of my second year and third year were a bit better because of that.
Thank you so much for sharing that, because I know that's not easy, but it's interesting you say about the intuition. I've actually been that for someone before and in a very, very similar situation. When you were going through those struggles versus where you are today, what have you reworked in your relationship with food and with the gym? Because those are very linked.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting because my relationship with food and the gym, I never directly worked on those things. I never came up with ways to eat or ways to exercise that would help me. What I did was I worked on my opinion of myself. And as I said before, these behaviors for me were a way of proving to myself that I was quote unquote masculine, which was basically just a word I was using for self-worth, you know, for worthy as a human being, a good enough person, so to speak. And I didn't feel like I was. I felt like I'd seen what I'm supposed to be as a man, and I wasn't that. And therefore, I have to prove that I am by the, you know, being able to endure lots of pain, being really dedicated, being able to attract people, you know, these kind of things that I was so obsessed with. I needed to be these things. And when anything happened that proved that I wasn't those things, my whole life fell apart. So I did a great podcast with Dr. Amy Azeki, who you should get on. I don't know if she's still doing media stuff, but she's fantastic. And she told me this great metaphor, which was that a lot of people like myself will build their life on a pillar, where the base of the pillar is that body image, that those appearance concerns, that sense of identity. What it was for me was all around the body. So when something goes wrong, when something happens in your life that stops that gets taken away and the whole pillar falls down. Whereas what I did, which I didn't really realize I was doing, but I started building a pyramid. I started adding blocks to the base that I loved about myself, that I could respect about myself. You know, I think I'm kind of funny sometimes. I like that I'm smart and I can do, you know, these other things. I'm a good friend. I'm a good partner, all these kind of things. And that foundation means now that on a day where my body doesn't look how I want it to, or, you know, I just binge eat on something the same way that everyone does when you're a little bit sad or whatever, you know, just you kind of order a bit too much pizza or, you know, whatever. It doesn't ruin me. It doesn't make me feel like everything's over and I have to shut off from the world.
I love words. This is, you've probably never been asked this before. How did you use to define masculinity versus how do you define it now? If you could describe that.
I used to define it very much based off of, I don't think I could have given you words, but I my definition of masculinity was the perceptual. It was based off of what I saw my dad doing when I was a kid. My dad was what we would call, where I'm from, hard as nails. So he was, you know, he would really tough, very hard working. He's got scars on his face from playing rugby. He used to tell me all these stories. He used to take me down to the pub when I was a kid, and all his friends from when he was a kid would tell me all these stories of him getting in fights and, you know, playing sport, even though he'd like broken his arm and carrying on, and all these kind of like very stereotypical manly, tough man, you know, all that stuff. And I wasn't that, you know. My dad was fearless and could instill fear into other people. That was basically the messages I was given. And I'm not a particularly intimidating person. I'm quite tall. That's about all I had. But I'm very like gentle and soft, and that's just who I've always been. And I definitely wasn't fearless. I used to be terrified of the third Harry Potter film when the guy turned into a werewolf. When I was a kid, I just couldn't watch that. I used to run out of the room. So just it wasn't those things. And so I think I defined it as that. I defined it as the opposite of me. I defined it as what I saw. Whereas now I guess it's hard for me to take the academic hat off for this, because now I see it as what I see in my kind of academic studies, or looking at masculine theory and looking at these social norms that have historically been put on men. And, you know, people who just happen to be born with a penis, you know, they're told that they have to do the X, Y, and Z. And, you know, and it maybe had its purpose in certain places, but now all it does is just make a lot of people really sad, and it doesn't help. So now I see it as that, and I have the freedom. And although, you know, sometimes it's hard because society still leans on that so much, but I think a lot of the time now I have the freedom to kind of laugh at that, or like kind of see it as something that I don't need to align to. But at the same time, I do just want to add a little caveat, and then I will shut up, I promise, is that, you know, I really don't, whenever I talk about masculinity and these kind of things, one thing that I really want to be cautious of is if people listen to this podcast and they align with these things, I don't think you're necessarily a bad person, or you should feel ashamed for aligning with them, because I think when we shame people for, especially something like this, where it's this like fear and negative relationship with something that's normally built on a lack of self-worth, shaming them for clinging on to anything that would make them feel good doesn't help. It just makes them feel more scared, more alone, and maybe leads them to those scary places that we've been talking about. So, you know, I do just want to say, as much as I get it, I guess is what I'm saying. Like, I used to align with a lot of the things that the stereotypical stuff that you'd hear, traditional, masculine, etc. But it's so much freer to not. And I'm so glad that I've moved away from that. I'm so glad I had the opportunity to.
I'm going to sidebar real quick. You said you watched your dad, and I think the things that we ingest are so incredibly important. With women, I'm sure you read a lot about it. Barbie dolls, Disney princess movies. I've seen a lot of hate for those sort of things. Did what you ingested as a child, even beyond your dad, impact your view of muscularity?
Yeah, it's something, one thing that's really stood out to me recently, because I've been seeing like memes about it, which is great. And I may even put it in my thesis because it's almost laughably perfect. But one of my favorite films when I was a kid was the Disney animation of Hercules. And I've seen lots of memes recently about that because I love that film. I still love that film. But it's hilarious that Hercules is super strong from the get-go when he's this like skinny kid. But when he trains to be a hero, he has to like get super jacked. He has to get super, and there's this whole training montage where he gets super like muscular. He already had godly strength. Why did he need to get massive arms? But that, you know, again, it taught me, it doesn't matter how strong you, like, I feel like that to some degree internalized. It doesn't matter how strong you are or how capable you are. You just got to look amazing. And then, you know, there's a definition of what amazing is. We got to just look super jacked and then people will respect you. So I do think stuff like that certainly worked. Yeah.
That's hysterical. And I've never thought about that. I'm not sure if you know this, but the face characters, if you've ever been to a park, no guy technically has arms big enough to be Hercules. So they do something very interesting. And Gaston from Beauty and the Beast is very similar. Yeah. So that's getting me thinking about him as well, because he's very masculine in a lot of the ways that you describe. So for our audience who is, you know, a little bit younger, they're going to university right now. What are 2 to 3? I know this is a hard question. 2 to 3 tips and strategies you'd give them to sort of unravel and get to the core of their relationship with these things, whether it's food, whether it's muscularity, whatever it is. What are 2 to 3 tips you'd share with them or pieces of advice?
Yeah, luckily I'd listened to a couple episodes of the podcast before. I did some research, so I knew it was coming.
So you knew this was coming.
I'm still stumped though, but I have 2 off the top of my head. One of them is direct, one of them is maybe a little bit off, but I think it works. The first one, which I think is a bit more practical, is to, we haven't really spoke about it during this podcast, but social media plays a massive part in this, at least to the degree in which it is affecting what you're seeing and what you're normalizing, what you're assuming is normal. Have a real look at the types of things you're being sent on your social media and use the mute button or the unfollow button or the block button or whatever. I used to be so afraid of doing that because I thought it was a sign of weakness. I thought it was me not being able to handle looking at that thing. But, you know, we only have a finite amount of time on this earth, and we only have a finite amount of ability to focus on things and to actually like take in certain things. So we don't take in like 99.9% of the stuff that's going on the earth because it's physically impossible. So why are you choosing to take in stuff that's making you feel bad? So that would be my first thing, was that's my practical tip. And my second one, which I always bring up when I do kind of, when people ask me these kind of questions, which hopefully aligns, so I'm going to say it anyway, and hopefully you won't cut it out. If you do, no one will know, so it's fine, is I really love the philosopher Viktor Frankl. And there's a really great kind of line from some of Viktor Frankl's work that I don't get exactly right and will sound really depressing when I first say it, but then I'll explain it and it'll be a bit better. Viktor Frankl, he's categorized as an existential philosopher. And he says that he disagrees with a lot of the existentialists because they say that the meaning of life is about being able to handle the fact that it's meaninglessness. But Viktor Frankl says, actually, the meaning of life is being able to handle the fact that you can't rationalize life's meaninglessness, which sounds really depressing, but I'll explain it now. What I take from that is we all attempt to figure out a way to understand life and what it means and how we should live it and how others should live it. And we're all wrong. No one can rationalize it. No one can understand it. We can try, but we'll never get there. And we'll never know if we did anyway. And that feels so freeing to me that everyone is wrong. Everyone that I thought understood it is equally as wrong as I am. And I can choose to understand life in a way that makes me happy and makes me feel good and helps other people around me. And I, you know, I'm not always perfect. I'm sure Viktor himself wasn't always perfect, but you know, I think striving for that and to strive to see the world in a way that makes you feel good is so great. And questioning whether or not the things that people tell you will make you feel good actually will, and trying those out and, you know, kind of playing with those things. But yeah, those are my two.
I love those. Those are interconnected as well. And I often tell people, and I've had to think about this for myself, if you're engaging with a sort of music, a sort of movie, a sort of social media channel or post or whatever it is that you're watching, and you feel worse walking away from it versus better, that's a sign you need to let it go.
Couldn't agree more.
So here's another one. What is your life motto that you live by?
My life motto.
If you had to tattoo something on yourself, what would you tattoo?
This is like the super cheesy. I have two. So the super cheesy one was be yourself. And the caveat to that, which is I'd probably put an asterisk next to it, which is like, it's hard to be yourself because you don't really know what yourself is. And when I say be yourself, kind of what I mean is tackle with that constant understanding of yourself and the constant changing of yourself and constantly discovering that. My second one, which it's just something I often say to my partner whenever I'm stressed or whenever I'm whatever, when we're having conversations about, like, you know, PhD stress, etc., because it grounds me. And it's something I actually think I might get tattooed on me at some point, which is, I'm just a monkey on a big rock. I really love that because whenever I think about all these like massive kind of stresses and worries about my life and like how it's all so meaningful and also grand and whatever, and I just remind myself, I'm just like big monkey that thinks he knows things, floating on a big rock in the middle of nowhere, and it's fine.
I like that. It takes the pressure off.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I think it helps me at least, and maybe it helps some other people.
I like it. In closing, is there anything else that you want to say to our viewership that you wish you could have heard when you were in that first or second year of university?
It's okay to mess up. And that's not just academically with grades and those kind of things, but with making friends and with trying new things and with trying to be the person that you want to be. Sometimes you're going to mess up. Sometimes you're going to say and do the wrong thing, and that's all right.
George, I have had so much fun. I learned even more than I thought I would learn because this is a topic I've never explored. And so I feel like I was here being your student, and you did an excellent job teaching.
Oh, thank you. It's been really nice to be on.
Thank you for joining me on Campus Chronicles. I hope you found our discussion informative, inspiring, entertaining, and fun. We are always working hard to make sure that our episodes are the very best they can be, which means we need your help. If you liked what you heard, remember to hit the follow button on your favorite podcast platform and drop us a review. It helps us to connect with more students who are hungry for success. And remember, the journey never stops. Keep listening, keep learning, keep growing. See you next week for another amazing episode of Campus Chronicles.